Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Chasing Freedom Podcast with Noah and Jeff.
In this show, we're going to dive deep into flips, wholesales, holding rentals, and creatively structuring deals.
So that we can show you how you can achieve that lifestyle of freedom that you desire. Hey guys, welcome to the Chasing Freedom Show with Noah and Jeff. Well, today it's just Jeff. Noah's on a flight back from Texas, but I got my good buddy Jesse Wynn with me. He's in Delaware. 302 Assets is his company. The dude is a young tycoon. Like, he is going to be taking over. I have no doubt that by the time he's in his 30s, he's going to be a force in the real estate industry, and I'm excited to hear his story, how he got started in real estate, where he's going, and all the stuff in between. So Jesse, thanks so much for being with us today, man.
Hey, thanks a lot, Jeff. I really appreciate you having me here. It was just awesome meeting you guys out in Maui. Yeah. And meeting everyone else as well and hearing that you guys are doing this podcast as an endeavor on top of your whole real estate business. I just wanted to contribute and help out as much as I possibly could. And this has also helped me out as well, man.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I'm looking forward to it, man. So our show is mainly for new beginners in real estate, right? Like people getting started or maybe folks who have like done a couple deals and want to push deeper. So let's start. We start right at the beginning. What were you doing pre-real estate and what got you really your gears grinding on pursuing real estate as your business method?
Yeah, so back in high school, around 11th and 12th grade, for a little bit, backtracking, I'm 22 years old,
yeah.
Fresh out of college about 10 months ago now, so I graduated in 3.5 years. But prior to college, I was in 11th, 12th grade, I was working at Dunkin' Donuts at my local university. My mom had a job at the local university, and she got me in, you know, with the food contracting service. So I was just wiping tables, serving coffee, doing like a little barista work out there.
Yeah.
And on the side, my aunt and uncle were actually getting into real estate between 2014 and 2017, where they burned about 15 properties. And I had no idea what they were actually doing, what their exit strategies were, until like I was farther along and looked back in foresight that they were killing it in the game.
Yeah.
And what I was doing was I was cleaning the houses once it was, you know, when it was totally renovated, nice, fixed up. They would pay me like $250 to clean like a 2,000 plus square foot house. And these are some really nice remodels, like full guts, like hardwood floors. And it was just a lot of cleaning. And, you know, a young kid just would do anything for money.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
A young, hungry kid. I was cutting grass as well.
Yeah.
I was cutting grass for about, you know, 10 lawns, $30 a lawn. And I was just so exhausted, walking about 15,000 to 20,000 steps a day whenever, you know, I had those days, you know, every other week. And that was pretty much my whole gig. I was working at the grocery store, cleaning houses, and I was cutting grass. And, you know, during high school, I also ran cross country and track. So that kind of fed into my competitive spirit.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. So it sounds like you always had a little bit of an entrepreneurial itch, whether you, I don't know, maybe at the time you didn't know it, but I was my neighborhood lawn boy too. And I find that a lot of guys who get started in real estate, that was their gig, right? Like for some reason, I would love for like all of us to get like a psychoanalysis someday and figure out like what actually makes our brain tick so differently. But like, we're all the lawn boys. We're all side hustling. I was selling different grass other than clipping grass as well, but that's for another story. But it was just always this hustle that I wanted to pursue. So you're working a job, you're running cross country, and once high school's done, then you're going to college, you're working at the college, you're clipping grass, and you're cleaning houses. What's the next step? How did you get involved in what you're doing now?
So there was actually a step between high school and college where I got my realtor license between the summer of senior year. That summer going into freshman year, I got my realtor license. I got that initially in New Jersey where my family was, helping them source out deals. And then I was going to college in Delaware. So then I just got I just took the law exam. And then it was just so easy to get the Delaware realtor license. And I was just trying to sell houses and hustle. And I was just terrible at it, honestly. I probably sold 4 other people's houses in the last 4 years just in total, or helped somebody buy a house. But it's mostly been my own products that I've just been redistributing.
Yeah.
And I just realized, you know, one of the big things was I was seeing how investors were getting off market deals, and there were these agents that were bringing it to them. And I was just like trying to figure out how were they doing it.
Yeah.
And what one of my guesses was, oh, they're door knocking. So I tried door knocking in a neighborhood in a suit, and it was just like, oh, this is horrible. It's like, I don't know how anybody could do this. So that was telling me, hey, I was onto something. I just didn't know how they were essentially producing the result of getting that marketing leads, yeah. You know? So that was kind of my attempt of getting into wholesaling without actually like doing enough research into it. And I just took my first step and I just did not think. And I just went in there, knocked on doors, didn't get the results, was not super consistent, didn't like, recalculate the method in a way. So then, you know, if what the next time I go back around at it, maybe I'd be more effective. I just totally gave up in that. So it kind of took like another year before I got into like driving for dollars, and that's how I landed my first deal.
Yeah,
get into that.
Let's jump into what is driving for dollars, because that's actually one of my favorite methods, and I think one of our most productive methods. So explain that for our listeners. What is driving for dollars?
Man, driving for dollars at the bare bones of it is either getting into your car, or if you don't have a car, getting on your bicycle or getting on your feet.
Yeah,
you know, and just going around neighborhoods that make sense in terms of houses that you want to buy. Mm-hmm. So you can't just go into like the $500,000, $600,000 plus like nicer neighborhoods. We're looking more so at the not so much the city as well. Yeah. Just really depends on what you're looking for. But, where the big buyers or the most average real estate buyers, they're buying with after repair values of $200,000 to $300,000 in our market. So I was looking at these neighborhoods that were, you know, just middle class, really average. And we would just go around and look for dilapidated houses. So what that meant was, hey, do we see any plywood on the windows? That's kind of rare. Do we see long grass? That's a little bit more common. Do we see really ugly asbestos siding? Just a little bit more common in these neighborhoods. How old does that roof look? Is there moss growing on that roof? How deferred is the maintenance? Hey, do you need dual pane windows when you got like single pane wood windows? It's just like, how crappy is it? I went to a recent meetup where I was able to speak there because my friend hosted it.
Nice.
And I was just showing up on my phone what the picture of the first house looked like, and you know, the Google car drove by it, and it hasn't driven by since we did the remodel.
Yeah.
But they drove by the house, and there's just this gigantic bush of like weeds, like just in front of the house. You can't even see the house. Yeah. That's how bad it was. And yeah, we had to do quite a bit of landscape manicuring in order to like look nice. But that was absolutely the worst house we saw in the neighborhood. I cannot believe that lead actually converted.
I want to talk about something you said there that surprisingly hasn't come up on our show yet. You said there's two sides of this. One, like it depends on what market you're in, but what I like that you said is you studied the demographics of your market and you realized where the majority of your buyers were. A lot of people miss out on that. There's a lot of people who get started in flipping and they want to flip a house that they would want to live in, right? Like we see this so often. They're like, oh, it's like right now we're doing like our first $1 million flip and it's going to be awesome. But never would I have done that 3 years ago. And that's a house I would love to live in. But the demographic doesn't support like doing a ton of those flips. So I think what you said there is when you're getting into driving for dollars, look at the demographics, determine where the majority of the people who are buying houses in your market are actually buying. What zip codes, what neighborhoods, what style of house, what back end purchase price really is extremely important, because you don't want to go and do a flip that you only have, you know, 10% of the market share is going to be looking at this house, right? You want to go and do the flip that 90% of the people who are looking for a home can afford this house. So I think that's a really good point. Are you guys using like the Deal Machine app for driving for dollars, or what's your method on doing that?
Yeah, initially we were using the Deal Machine app and it was just like, it felt weird. Like we would just come by, take a picture of the house and this was, just send out the mail and just drive by it as fast as we can without looking like super shady or getting the cops called on us. There was another marketing tactic where we were doing bandit signs, just hanging up signs like at 12 to 3 a.m. and it's just like, man, we're just trying not to get called by the police out here.
Did you build the little custom pole extender to put your bandit signs really high? Did you?
Dude, someone else already made that invention. Yeah, so I bought it off of them.
So yeah, when we did our first bandit Saigon, it was like 7 years ago. But yeah, we did the same thing, bro. Like 40 bandit signs in the car, 2 a.m, rolling around the neighborhood. We had this big old extender with the hammer tack, and we'd put them up like 30 feet up so nobody could take them down. But man, that's cool. Listeners, Deal Machine app is a great tool because, like you said, it's super simple. You take a picture and you literally click a button, and then it puts it into your lead funnel, and then you can decide to start mailing that lead funnel or not. I actually did, I was in Indianapolis like four or five weeks ago. I'm a big Seahawks fan. We had opening day against the Colts, and we invest in Indiana. So I'm like, oh, that's a win-win. I'm going to go. I got one of them little electric scooters, bro, and I was riding around neighborhoods doing scootering for dollars on my Deal Machine app, and I got like 250 leads in like an hour of riding my scooter. I was like, dude, this was totally worth it. So it's a very, one, it's a low cost method. And then two, it's a very easy kind of automated method aside from the actual driving part. But after you select the lead, it's pretty automated. So I'm glad you brought driving for dollars up. So you're driving for dollars. You got your first house. It's the ugliest house. The lead converted. Walk us through what that project looked like, how you acquired it, funding source, and what you did with that property.
Yeah, this is actually one of the most crazy stories that, you know, I don't really get to share very often because it's kind of a lengthy one. It was quite a process. But for one, I wanted to say that I didn't do it by myself. It came with a partner. My partner was, his name is Johnny.
Okay.
And we were still friends to this day. And his dad actually flipped 90 houses between like 2015 and 2019. And we started December of 2019.
Awesome.
We essentially just figured out what neighborhoods he was buying in, and that was pretty much where all his competitors and all the other people were buying in. So that's how we essentially got to that neighborhood. And the thing was that his dad told us, hey, I'll help you guys fund whatever deal you guys need to fund, and I'll help out with construction so you guys don't get screwed with those costs.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you need to find the deal.
Yeah.
You guys just need to go do it. So what happened was we drove for 5 weeks, one day every single week, invested about 2 hours, and it was just a consistency in that.
Yep.
And so we probably mailed out about 400.
Okay.
Probably 400 mailers, and probably, you know, spent about $400-$500 just in total to get this lead. So by spending $500, we got really lucky, got this lead, came in there, and the lady was essentially washing dishes out of the bathtub because the plumbing was so bad and busted that you would need to jack up. Like, you know, this house was on a slab.
Mm-hmm.
So that means, you know, it's a rancher and you need to redo the piping from the slab. And we didn't have any idea how deep it went or how far out to the sewer it went. So they were telling us, Horizon, which is like the really big plumbing company.
Yeah.
They were quoting them for like $20,000. And we're just like, okay, well, we'll write that down in our rehab numbers, you know? Well, we like estimated this rehab so poorly, like $100,000 for this rehab. And we were just like, you know, we don't know any better. If Johnny's dad came in here and like estimate, he was just like 50, 60 max. And he didn't tell us this. So we were just like, 100 house sells for probably 230. And then like, so we offered 65, and then the lady was like, are you serious? Like, you guys gonna give us 65? I was like, oh, no, hey, let's wait for you. They got we're getting there. Like, I was just like, hey, let's set up something with you and your husband and me and my partner. So we come back in a couple of days, and we're just like, oh man. I mean, when Johnny and I got back into our cars that day and got 65, we were just like, oh my gosh, we're going to make some money. Yeah. And I was like, oh, this is exciting. That whole moment of like, you know, landing your first verbal negotiation in a deal is just so exhilarating.
Yeah.
And we were just like, oh my gosh, like kids again. But then, you know, we go back and have this meeting with her and her husband, just like, hey, I know we said like 65, but we ran back and did our numbers and we could do 58.5. I don't know if this is 58,500. I'm not sure if this will work out for you. And little did we know, like, they had another offer on the table, but it was like low 50s for all closing costs.
Yeah.
And we were offering 58.5, where we only pay our closing costs and they pay theirs, but it's basically almost the same.
Yeah.
But they liked how we spent the time to work with them.
Yeah.
And they were trying to move to Indiana.
Okay.
Just to watch out or just watch over their grandkids. They have 8 kids and they had a bunch of grandkids coming on the way. and they just want to spend time with their family. So yeah. One of the big lessons is that we had to prioritize and learn what the seller wanted yep. in order for us to get what we wanted. We yep. had to prioritize their needs and their interests before we looked after our own, so that we were providing a real service
yeah.
rather than just people look at this deal and it's like, oh, you guys stole their house. I'm just like, well, we did a lot more. We found their apartment.
Yeah.
We figured out like where they could buy a truck, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And so that they can move all their stuff.
Yeah.
We basically, you know, helped out with the logistics in moving to Indiana, as well as cleaning out their house and letting them leave wherever they want.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, they didn't have that much cash in order to call like maintenance people or call contractors.
Yeah.
And they didn't have that experience.
Yeah. You know, oftentimes it's not just the purchase price that matters, right? Like mm-hmm. it in traditional real estate, everyone's like, oh no, you got to pay what they're asking. You got to give them a bunch of money. It's not always the purchase price. You guys were able to offer a service by providing a moving, by helping with Indiana, like that stuff that other people aren't willing to do. And that comes with a price tag associated with it. So say that house is worth 70, but the services that you guys are offering is 12.5. Well, then now you get back to your 58.5 number. And that's a fair price because of the services that you added on top of that price. So I think that's a key, is understanding that purchase price isn't always everything, right? Like there's other things that you can do to close that deal. So I think that was really smart of you guys. Also, one thing I wanted to circle back on that you said in the beginning of this particular project that I think is huge is we often get people who will be like, hey, I know my house is a fixer and here's what I want to sell it for. And yeah, here's this plumbing. Ours is called Meridian Plumbing. They're like the big plumbing service. Here's this plumbing estimate for 20 grand. And here's this roof estimate for 12 grand. Well, as a flipper, we got way better rates than that. We're using our plumbing that we use all the time in our roofer. But I dang sure am now calculating, like you said, that's the number that goes into my rehab budget now, because that's the number that's real to them, because that's the option that they have. They don't have my relationships to get a lower cost. So now I get to go and utilize 25 grand off of, you know, hey, I know you think your house is worth two, but it actually is going to need 80K in renovation. Well, I can get it done for 45, but their cost is 80. So that's what's relevant. So I like that you said that in the beginning of the story. I just wanted to highlight that. But all right, so you negotiated, you got the deal. Walk us through what happens next.
Well, we had like 3 months to get the financing because they weren't ready to sell until like January. And this was like September. So it's just like, we look back at it now and it's like, how did they have 8 kids and none of them were like a huge objection? So I go to these sales, these sales trainings nowadays and they're just like, overcome every possible objection, create objections for yourself and overcome them. Yeah. And I was like, we didn't do that. We got really lucky. So that's one of the things that didn't happen that we're really blessed about. But another thing was I was trying to find a private lender before. Mm. I knew I didn't want to pay hard money. I was just like, oh, you're talking 14%, 3 or 4 points. I was like, I'm not doing that. So I go find somebody. It was like my boss at work who had like a big IRA.
Yeah.
And they've never invested in real estate. So this is my mistake. So I asked somebody who did not invest in real estate before, hey, will you like lend $60,000 to do this project essentially? And, you know, we had a verbal for basically 2 months and then 2.5 months. And then the week before closing, which was very vividly like the first week of December. It was like the last week of November. They got cold feet and it's like, hey, I can't fund the deal. My financial can't do this. They're not going to let me do this. So
could you,
that's what,
Jesse, let's push back about 30 seconds. I lost the audio on you. You saying that they backed out at the very end and just said their financial partner wasn't wanting to go through with it.
Yeah, no. So generally, these people who have like big IRAs or have accounts, they'll have a financial advisor who is also managing their money.
Yeah.
And the thing is, these people want to keep the money in the fund so they can make their commissions.
Yeah,
and that's what I've been learning over time. And it sucks because like these are smart people, but they trust people who have like this title
or
the certification, which is great and all. But like they're not analyzing the full picture for their own personal benefits.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, so their financial person basically said, hey, don't do this. This is not in your best interest. So they backed out and I basically had set 7 days to figure out where I was going to get the money.
Yeah.
And I was like working a job at the same time. And I was like calling 20 people that I thought who may have the money. And it turns out everybody that I thought had the money did not have any money. The craziest thing. And then like, I'll call my dad's second and third cousin or something like that. Because the thing is, my parents had a little bit of money after like cashing out of a flip at the moment, but my dad really wanted me to do it on my own. Yeah. He was just like, Jesse, I want you to figure it out. Cause you know, if I just provide for you this entire time and I open up the doors for you, it's just like, do you really understand what it takes?
Yeah. I like that perspective. This is like,
this is a guy who, you know, he learned how to do all his own contracting work. And now he's like basically my project manager, running crews, like doing really, really nice work.
Yeah.
But he's not the business guy, you know, but he knows how to not be taken advantage of and he knows how to work hard and hustle. So that was the principle in it. But when I started calling my dad's second and third cousins, they're just like, oh, we lent to your dad back in the day on these projects. Like, that sounds cool. How much you need? And they were like, sure, 30 and 30. And then they ring up my dad. And now my dad's just like, oh, shoot, you're making me look bad to my cousins. So my dad comes to me and just like, hey, your uncles are going to write me the check. And then I'm going to cut it to you so you can do this closing. Little did I know. My mom actually told me like a week later, hey, your dad actually cut those checks himself. He's just trying to say that to save face.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to see.
He was like, I was teaching you a lesson, boy.
Yeah. He didn't want to be seen as like the bad guy to his like family. It's just like, what? Yeah. You're not going to support your son and what he's doing? He's doing the same thing as you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, my dad helped me close that deal. But the deal was actually like, hey, I'll close it, but you need to give me 30 grand back. So we had like another week or 2 weeks to find 30 grand.
Okay.
And I ended up taking a loan shark loan for like 30 grand for like $900 a month.
Okay.
Yeah. On 30, it was just ridiculous, but we had to do what we had to do.
Yeah. You got
to
make the deal work. Yeah.
Yeah. And then that was also part of, you know, my testimony of how, I shared with people over the Maui page, hey, I raised 25, 30 grand across like six college students who gave me $5,000 a piece.
Yeah.
And that's how we pieced together half of the rehab.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were 90% done, I brought in somebody who lent me the last 25, you know, on a 10% note. And they were actually a private lender.
Nice.
So I did all private financing for the rehab. So 55,000 altogether across seven different people at 10%. And that was essentially how, you know, we did that first deal and financed it.
You had a little mini syndication going on.
Dude, it was the most whack thing of all time. Probably extremely illegal. I don't know. I really don't know. These people had, the people who lent me $5,000, they had notes, some unsecured promissory notes. And, you know, the one guy who had $25,000, I told him, hey, I'll give you a mortgage on the property.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right. So you get the property, you figured out, you got all the funding. How long did the flip take and how much did you spend?
It was 3 months.
Okay.
And it took $55,000, $55,000 to $60,000 to redo all the plumbing, HVAC, new electrical, new drywall, new flooring. It needed the whole.
Man, I need to come out to Delaware, bro. I spend $60,000 on floors, paint, and cabinets in my market. Like,
are you serious?
Yeah. Oh, Boise's expensive, bro. Like, a cosmetic flip on like a 1,500 square foot house cost me like $40,000. But like I see folks, like we have some of our rental units in Indiana, and we had to essentially do a cosmetic flip that would have cost me like $20,000 here. Just paint the cabinets, new counters, refinish some stuff and paint, and then do new carpets. And I was like, all right, I was expecting $20,000. I was like, that kind of sucks. And then I got the bill and it was like $6,500. And I was like, bro, I want to do that more. Like, that was rad. So, all right. So you spent about 60. All right. So you picked it up at, we're just going to round up to 60, right?
60. Bought at 60.
Okay. So you got it at 60. You spent 60. So you're in 120 before financing somewhere around 10 to 15 grand total.
Yeah, probably around there.
All right. So we're going to say we'll say like 132.5. What'd you go on to sell that property for?
We sold it for $257,500, giving out probably $14,000 of closing help. We sold it in May of 2020, which was when the pandemic was basically freezing the housing market. Yeah. And we were just like, we don't know if we're going to get a buyer. We should have held it, and then we would probably got $30,000 more.
Yeah, in hindsight, right? And so, and then you still have your license, so did you list this?
I did list it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, and you say you sold for $230,000? Or 250.
257.5.
And then dropped 14. Man, you guys made a killing on that project.
We made six figures on the project.
That's the freaking awesome. The big thing was that
we used like my friend, his dad's resources. My friend project managed everything. I just basically was the visionary, bringing in the money, selling the vision to other people. Basically what I'm doing today. But my friend helped alleviate a huge load. He never signed a piece of paperwork. It was crazy. I was like, this guy really trusted me with his life, essentially.
Yeah.
It's like,
So you make six figures on the first flip. That's probably one of the most impressive first flip stories I've heard. Normally, like my story, like I made literally like the market bailed me out and I made $5,000. Like that's how I got started. So all right, you make 100K plus somewhere around there. What's next? How do you redeploy that money? What do you do? Because now you're like, I can do this. Right? Like before, like you're a pretty confident guy. I'm sure you're like, hey, this is going to go well, but there's probably some seed of doubt, right? Or some limiting belief or some ceiling that you put on yourself. Am I really the guy that's going to go flip houses and make money? Well, then you go and freaking crank out a $100,000 flip on your first one. You're like, damn right, I'm that guy. So what did you go and do after that? Like where are you at now and how'd you get rolling?
So I took that money and I invested into education. So smart. I bought Steve Trang's like private money course with Nice. Day. I've also bought some AdWord nerds. These are some guys that I paid money to so that they can help me with my, not SEO, it's PPC. They were helping me with PPC. Yeah. I invested in some VAs to help me build out a website. Nice. So DelawareHomeBuyers.com.
Oh, very cool.
And then I invested in some VAs to do some cold calling for me. And I started learning about the whole wholesaling business, legitimately. Cause I was just like, I need to scale this out. I can't just have one marketing channel.
Yeah.
I can't just be driving for dollars. So as soon as I got the money, I was just blowing it kind of in a sense on education. And I learned that some things work for me and some things don't work for me, but I just needed to get out there and learn it for myself. But the cold calling has like brought in another 10 to 15 deals.
Really? Were those wholesale deals or you flipped those?
No, they were buy and hold deals.
Oh, nice. So very cool.
I've actually never wholesaled a deal.
Okay.
But like every single deal that I was able to take down was essentially wholesalable.
Yeah.
Probably for $10,000 to $15,000 fee.
Killer.
Yeah. And that's like, you know, you're having your ARV minus or your ARV times 30% minus repairs, you know, and minus my $10,000 to $15,000 fee. It was that good of a deal. So me being the type of like, you know, so like, I can't really afford this deal. It's like, no, I asked myself, how am I going to afford this deal? I always ask myself that.
That's good.
That's kind of the reason why I didn't wholesale the six-figure deal when we could have made a $60,000, $70,000 fee. I didn't know what wholesaling was.
Yeah.
I didn't really understand it. I just was like, well, I already know flips. So I'm just going to try to take it down. So I take these deals down and I came across a seller that did a seller finance note for like three houses that they owned. And it was like 20% down and 80% interest only for 5 years.
Oh, that's killer.
So it was killer. So for three houses, I'm paying $500 a month and the cash flow on that is about $2,800.
That's rad. What did you do for the 20%? Did you just use that from the 100K that you had made, or did you raise that elsewhere, or partnerships, or?
I raised $25,000 out of private money, and I used my own money.
Okay,
so I paid. So I'm still paying that lender $25,000. It was a doctor. It was a doctor friend of mine.
Yeah,
he's just like, $25,000. He didn't even like take a mortgage on it. He was just like, just give me a promissory note.
Yeah.
So I just pay him $208. 33 cents. That's 10%.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
I pay him that every single month. Goes on clockwork, and I make the cash flow in the house. And I'm currently renovating them so I can bump rents up.
Yeah. Once you, I was gonna say, are you gonna do the Burr method and cash out refi? But I guess there's really no point while you're in that 5 year period because you got such a favorable owner carry, right?
Yeah. Plus, these are some smart investors. They were in the business for 30 years, and they were just like, "Hey, if you cash out."
Prepayments.
You pay us, prepayment penalties, like, you know,
less. I mean, but honestly, with the 5 year owner carry, though, like, there's no point, right? You just take that 5 year owner carry, interest only, it sucks. You're not really paying down the principal, whatever. You're getting good cash flow that then allows you to do different stuff in life and be a little more aggressive. And then you do the cash out refi at that 5 year term. So that's not.
I'm actually looking at a small bank, and they actually did, when they were running me through for a home equity line against these products, they actually didn't see the mortgage from the sellers. So what happened was they think I own it free and clear. They're about to give me like $100,000 line of credit. So after I filed my taxes for this year and then filed my taxes for 2020 or 2021, like in January, I'm going to go qualify for a bunch of different lines of credits.
Yeah.
And, you know, try to push my business forward with that money.
Okay, solid, man. All right, so let's catch up. So you did first flip, made six figures, and then you got 10 to 15 buy and holds, and did you keep all of those?
Yeah, right now, today, I'm at 15 buy and holds with a combination of seller finance, subject to financing. I've used bank finance. I'm living in a fourplex right now. So
awesome.
I'm house hacking.
What's what's your total cash flow, like net cash flow that you take from those 15 units altogether each month?
It's about $4,000 to $4,500.
Man, yeah. That is killer. So you're 22 years old. Yeah, $4,200 a month in cash flow. And you're still doing flips, right?
I'm still doing flips. I'm looking to scale down. And then I thought that, you know, I renovate these houses from the ground up, essentially tearing out drywall, mm-hmm. redoing plumbing systems. And I just felt so bad selling them. So now I'm looking into doing Airbnb where if I make them, I can kind of customize them from the very beginning to like my taste or whatever's the most trendy taste.
Yeah.
And then I can essentially lease them out, and 1 year of revenue is essentially the profit of one flip. Plus I get depreciation and appreciation.
Yeah. So that's, let's hit on that real quick. Cause that's actually our strategy. So we're on track to do about 40 flips this year. And about 3 months ago, we finally got a CPA who knows real estate and understands what he's doing. And he was like, "Hey, you guys are idiots. You made way too much money this year and you're going to pay way too much money in taxes. So you need to start holding stuff so that you can depreciate those assets." Well, doing BRRRRs in our market doesn't really make sense if you're just going to have it be a traditional rental. Because you're talking about like, so here's an example of one that we're in the refi process right now. The house value is 535. I'm in it at like 440. So at a 80% loan to value, I'll pretty much cash out. I might leave a little bit in the deal. I might make a little bit depending on where we come in on appraisal. But that asset that I will have a $450,000 note on, it will only rent out for $1,900 a month on traditional rental. So it doesn't work. Like it literally doesn't even cover the debt service coverage ratio. Like I cannot get approved for that commercial loan product, right? So what we have to do is convert everything to Airbnbs because that same property on Airbnb will fetch me $6,000 a month. So now it makes sense. So let's talk about that. What's the benefit to holding these assets for you? Explain what depreciation kind of looks like in your world, and then why Airbnb rather than traditional rentals in your market?
Yeah, I really like how the Airbnb market is essentially up and coming.
Yeah.
It's growing. Right now, the largest Airbnb market right now in the United States is the Smoky Mountains, and they're about getting 12,000 visitors year after year, wow. even through COVID. So with 3,000 Airbnbs and 12 million visitors, you know, we see a big shortage, and that's the biggest market. So let's say we're looking at smaller, nicer vacation spots or that have year round, like skiing, hiking, you know, fall foliage, have all these different amenities or even water parks.
Yeah.
We're currently in one in Pennsylvania right now called the Poconos. You know, it's a 2 hour market away from me and my partner.
Yeah.
And we're just like, we're able to go in there and then we create these 50-50 partnerships with financial partners, investors, just basically my friends and family.
Yeah.
And they'll basically get the deal, the loan. Or we get the deal, they bring in the loan, put in the 10%, they give me the money to furnish it and to close the deal and pay all these other miscellaneous expenses. And I have no risk to assume except the opportunity cost.
Yeah.
So they get 50-50 for doing nothing except putting up the money and qualifying for the loan, and we operate it. So I'm creating a whole business right now based off of acquisitions and operations of Airbnbs.
Yeah.
And then we're going to scale this around the nation. So we're starting in the Poconos.
Yeah.
And we're first going off market. And as we learn more about it, we can buy stuff on market because we know our numbers.
Yeah.
And we can buy houses just based off of comparables because some people will try to sell their houses for like NOI or like commercial properties, but they're not going to get that number because that's compared to your neighboring property.
Yeah.
But so we know something that some other people don't know. So we're willing to pay full price asking, knowing that, hey, we're putting less money down anyways, like 10% down. Like your cash on cash is going to be astronomical.
Yeah.
So when we're taking those factors into account and running our numbers, we're creating cash on cash returns of 40 to 60 to 110%, you know, plus sometimes. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
We split that 50-50 and basically our company creates an infinite return on our investment.
Yeah, that's killer. So you guys are really like, you're kind of reinventing like, it's kind of like this hybrid, right? Like you're managing it. But you're not just collecting. So what we do in our market is we have a management company we use. We make 80% and they make 20%. But that's because I found the deal. I rehabbed it. I burned it. I did all that. You're kind of creating this little middle ground where you're the acquisitions guy. And that, like, the deal, the house is what matters most in this market. Like, money, five to 7 years ago, money was really hard to get. But now money's easy to get. And so the deal is the hot commodity. So you guys are able to negotiate a freaking awesome split where you're taking 50% of the profit because you're the deal sourcer. And then you're also doing the management on the back end. So essentially you're getting 20% for the management on the back end and then 30% for being the acquirer of the property and setting everything up. That's pretty killer.
Yeah. I mean, the hardest part is setting up the property and making sure you're creating the vibes that you need to so that you can create that performance. So when you're doing all that due diligence and all that upfront work, like, of course, like 50% is kind of generous because you're bringing all this experience versus if a mom and pop person tried to do this same thing, they'd be running to the Poconos or wherever, like 15, 20, 30 different times, running back and forth, wasting all this time when they should be, you know, being a superintendent, a lawyer, being a doctor, doing what they're doing, you know, and not focusing on this side business.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, like a lot of the guys who want to fund these as passive investments, they just don't have the time to do it. So to partner with a guy like you, who this is your sole focus here, you have teams and systems built out to help with that. That's really beneficial to them. Are you buying these turnkey right now, or are you doing like value adds on them?
We do a combination of both, but for the most part, we want to buy more expensive properties so we could depreciate. Because what I learned is that you can't just rehab a property and depreciate off of ARV. You need to depreciate based off what you paid minus the land.
Yes.
So when you have a more expensive property, we value that.
Yeah.
So we count that into our overarching ROI, but we sell cash on cash return when we talk to our partners.
That's actually a really good pitch. I like that. One of the things I like that you said too is that, and I think that the one danger that I see in Airbnbs is it's the marketing that you see from some of these other folks selling single family residences as Airbnbs. So I just got sent one that was a duplex and they're like, hey, pay me $600,000 for it. And I'm like, bro, the comp on that is like 520 all day. I'm not giving you 600. That's $80,000 over value. And their argument was, here's the cap rate based on our Airbnb numbers. I'm like, no, I'm not buying a business right now. I am buying a single family asset, or a four and under, I consider single family, even if it's a duplex. So I'm buying a single family asset and it needs to comp out, just like you said, it has to comp out with the surrounding comps, with the surrounding houses. You don't get to create a cap rate based on the Airbnb. So that's the one danger that I see for new investors getting into the Airbnb arena, is that they get pitched a higher price than what the comps support based on the Airbnb number. And while sure, that might be okay in the short term if the Airbnb runs like it's supposed to, but what happens if that neighborhood or that HOA or that jurisdiction decides to put regulations on Airbnbs? Well, now you just bought a project or a product that only makes sense as an Airbnb business. You overpaid because somebody sold you the Airbnb numbers. And now if the regulations change and you can't Airbnb it, you're overvalue on a house that doesn't cash flow as a single family rental. So one of the only, like, I guess, asterisk I always tell people is Airbnbs are awesome, but don't buy it based on it being a business. Buy it based on the price that still the comps support. And it sounds like that's what you're saying as well. Don't look at the NOI. Don't look at the cap rate. Look at what the comps support for it. And then get your upside. You can still think about your upside, but don't go paying like a business number for a single family house.
Yeah, one of the big things is that though we're showing like 60% plus on cash on cash returns, we always disclose it to our partners and say, hey, in the worst case scenario, if we have to sell this for break even or even at a small loss, think of this as like your overarching investment, like internal rate of return. What did you get overall in terms of return versus what you put in? So maybe your internal rate of return could be less in the worst case scenario, that we have to pay realtors to pay this house or like sell this house for us. And then, you know, we sell at a loss. Well, at the end of the day, you made a return on the cash that you put in, and you got out of the house with a net positive, because we were operating the business in that time. So we always got to be agile and flexible and always be kind of micromanaging our portfolio and making sure, hey, all the bylaws are, you know, in favor of us supporting this Airbnb model and just allowing us to do this legally in the right way. So we buy in more established markets that already labeled out the bylaws when it comes to Airbnb. So we're not, you know, it's not a matter of if, but when they regulate it.
Yeah.
We already know that it's already regulated.
Yeah.
And we want to be within the fine line and running a business based off of real rules.
Yeah. I like that, man. I think that's smart. Real quick before I let you go, I want to kind of touch base on what What kind of systems are you having to build? Because going national is not easy, right? Like running 10 Airbnbs in your local market, like that's not that difficult. There's some self-management guys that do that. But what kind of stuff are you putting in place? What type of team are you building to allow you to be confident in saying, I'm going to take this national and make this a product available to a ton of partners?
So I have a guy currently, his name is Carlos. He's my partner.
Okay.
And he has a day job, and he's waking up at 6 a.m. to analyze properties. He's also my internal sales guy, helping me out with that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I kind of lost the hunger to make phone calls. Like I just hated it so
much.
I
feel you on that one.
So he's, you know, taking the leads and trying to make something with it, analyze it. I have my two VAs in the Philippines generating. So mostly everything has been cold call and pulling lists. And, you know, I have my fiance helping me set up Airbnbs, shop everything. Mm-hmm. I have a community on Facebook. It's off this guy named Rob Built.
You know,
he's really known for doing really creative Airbnbs.
Yeah, he's got some cool stuff.
Yeah. So I'm part of his program, and we have a really great community on there. So I have like checklists and everything so we can set up. So then I have, you know, my financing partners. We could buy Airbnb in each market, each state, essentially, with that second home loan. And when it comes to management, I try to automate as much as I possibly can.
Yeah.
So I'll have like an auto message to the guests with Hospitable.
Yeah.
And then I'll also have electronic key locks.
Yeah.
So we don't have to mess with lock boxes. So I recommend Schlage, which is like a $200 lock, which is ridiculous, but you know, you get notifications if you want them.
Yeah.
I also have cameras on site making, and then I also have like smoke detectors that detect decibels. And you know, you don't have crazy parties at your house. Just trying to check off all my, my dots and, you know, cross off my T's so I can make my business as efficient as possible and being within the lines and not getting so many, complaints in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, eventually I want to hire an executive assistant so then they can do all the monitoring for me or guest interactions. Cause right now my fiance is helping out with guest interactions. And I'm just raising the money and building the relationships so I could, you know, scale the business.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. What are you doing as far as setting up maintenance and cleaning contacts in those other markets? Is it just, hey, call, get a list of people, sell them on the vision, or what are you doing for that? Cause that's the one big, and maybe it's not a concern, but that's the one thing that I don't want people to miss, right? Is like, if a toilet plugs, you got to have somebody that goes and runs that and gets that fixed for your tenant, right? So going national, what are you doing to get ahead of those types of things?
You got to have three to five contacts before you even launch.
Yeah.
In order to, you know, have somebody who's going to pick up. And for the most part, you know, the same guy who cuts our grass, we've seen how reliable he is.
Yeah.
They say inside the Bible, even like, hey, those who could be trusted with little could be trusted with a lot.
Yeah.
So that, you know, we're trying to build those relationships out with people. And then our cleaners, like I generally, I get referrals from people over Facebook and I interview them and then see if any of them have any Airbnb experience or have worked in hotel industry.
Yeah.
So, and you That's know, good. It's a core, we're trying to compete with the hospitality industry against hotels. So if you could find anybody who knows that space, who knows how to be efficient, who also like, for instance, the extra value that our cleaner brings is that they used to inspect for bed bugs.
Yeah.
And that's just a huge thing. Cause it's not that your furniture may have bed bugs, but people from the outside, they could be dirty and they bring in bed bugs to your unit. So I'm really glad that somebody, you know, they sold themselves and they basically bring in that extra value for your business.
Yeah.
So that's a huge thing.
Yeah, that's awesome. One of the things that we're doing even in our local market is we've given our cleaners a checklist of maintenance items to look at every time they're in the house. So they don't have to be a maintenance guy. But one of the things I love about an Airbnb versus a long-term rental is a long-term rental, at best, you're getting in there once a month to assess how the tenants are treating that property. And that's very generous. It's probably more often like once a quarter, right? In the short-term rental, I'm getting eyes on that unit every single time a guest leaves. And if I prepare properly my cleaners with a list of 10 things, hey, obviously when you clean the toilets, flush every toilet, make sure there leaks, make sure the faucet's not leaking, check this. Then I know if any damage is happening in my product, in my property every like 3 to 5 days when they're cleaning those units. So that's one of the things I love about the Airbnb models. You get eyes on that unit so often, right? And then you can get ahead of maintenance compared to, Oh, Billy Bob Thornton forgot to tell you that he broke the faucet in his long-term rental 4 months ago and doesn't have water and tried to duct tape it. And now your subfloor is freaking molded out or something crazy, right? Like, you get the opportunity to get ahead of these things. So I think that's cool, man. I'm excited to see what you do. It's a very interesting strategy. I love the short-term rentals. I think it's funny, man. People think, like, I get this so often, like, oh, don't you think you're getting to the short-term rental market late? And I just kind of laughed at it, like, bro, no, like, this was, like, Airbnb launched in, like, what, like, 2012, 2014, somewhere in there. Like, it's not, like, it's barely about to hit 10 years. I'm not late to this. People see 10 years as, like, oh, you're late to the trend. Like, no, this is a reestablishing of a new line in the hospitality industry. Like, this is going to compete with hotels and resorts for literally ever. Like, I don't think Airbnb ever goes away. So people often hit me with, don't you feel you're coming to the game late? And I'm like, no, this is still in the infancy. Like, yeah, if you're looking at it of a 0 to 10 and I'm at the 10-year mark, I'm at the end. But I'm not looking at 0 to 10. I'm looking at 0 to forever and I'm at the 10-year mark. I'm in the infancy of this product. And I think there's a lot more to come of Airbnb. So I'm excited to see what you do with it, man. It's going to be pretty rad.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited too, because it's hard. At the end of the day, it's a business, yep. And not everyone is designed to be a business person. Yeah. So, you know, the people who get into it and they just maybe toss their house on Airbnb, they may like the money for a little bit, but when they start encountering problems or headaches, what are they going to do? Yeah. How are they going to solve those problems? Yeah. You know, and that's what would define the business owners from, that's, you know, good. Your mom and pops.
Yeah. And that's really good. Well, hey, man, we're running out of time here. Let me hit you with a couple of our closing questions. What podcasts or books do you listen to or read that you would recommend to anybody trying to get started in real estate or scale a real estate business?
Yeah, the first thing that really comes to mind is probably the Ryan Pineda Show and then the Iced Coffee Hour podcast by Graham Stephan. Because, you know, if you want some entertainment and you want some real value, you go to those guys.
Nice. I like it. What about books? Are you a big book reader?
Yeah. No, I recently read Vivid Vision and Who Not How. And those are the new Rich Dad Poor Dad. Yeah. Honestly.
I actually love that, man, because I've admitted this on the show before. Like, I'm probably like one of like one people I know that have not read Rich Dad Poor Dad. Like, I've never read it. Like, and everyone's like, oh, that was a book that got me started. I'm like, dude, I've never read it. And like, honestly, someday maybe I will for like the nostalgia of it, like, or I feel like I'm obligated to. But like, yeah, Vivid Vision. I like the Go Giver book. I'm reading Checklist Manifesto. Like, there's a ton of new stuff. Even Brandon Turner's The Multifamily Millionaire. There's a ton of new stuff on the market that I'm like, I can't go back. Like, maybe it was just because I was blind. Like, I didn't know what was out there in the world. So I just sprinted for real estate. Now I'm already here. I'm like, I'm not going to go back and read the book on like how to get started in real estate. I'm going to read these books that kind of like inspire me to push deeper into real estate. So
Rich Dad Poor Dad is kind of the Pokemon of real estate.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. Well, hey, Jesse, how can our listeners get a hold of you if they have any questions, or hey, maybe somebody wants to partner up on Airbnb? How do they get a hold of you, man?
Yeah, definitely hit me back up on Facebook at Jesse Nguyen or on Instagram at Jesse M. Nguyen. My last name is spelled Nguyen.
Awesome.
And my name is Jesse without an I, Jesse.
There you go.
So I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
We'll have those in the show notes as well for anybody who wants to hit Jesse up. He's got some super cool stuff going on. You can tell, like, this guy's 22, guys. Don't forget that. Like, I don't know if he's a fan of people calling him 22, but the guy is financially free at 22 and has huge stuff coming ahead. So Jesse, thanks so much for being on the show, man. I'm super excited to see what comes of this.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jeff. I really appreciate being here.
Appreciate you, brother.
All right, guys. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Chasing Freedom Podcast with Noah and Jeff.
Please subscribe to our YouTube channel in the show notes below. And if you ever want to get a hold of us, feel free to do it via our Instagrams. You can also follow us for our funny content on TikTok.